Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You are listening to Inside F1 with Joe Saywood on Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Inside F1 with Joe Saywood on Missed Apex Podcast. When you're done listening to Joe, check out our recent tech time with Summer's F1 and our last three race reviews from this thrilling triple header. I'm your host, Richard Spanners, ready, and this week I'm grabbing your attention by telling you I'm joined by Paddock Jewel, Joe Bazooka Saywood. How's it going, Joe?
Well, I've never been called bazooka before. I can have a fairly decent hitting power, but I've never thought of myself as a bazooka before.
And I did mean in the military sense, not the thing that got rid of zits for teenagers in the 90s. No, verrucas. It was verrucas, wasn't it, that you bazooka?
I have no idea. I left teenage years and verrucas behind long ago.
Well, finally, we're able to catch up with you after this really busy triple header. Now, Cyril Abidebo has said in motorsport.com that there's too many races. So, you know, do you agree with that? Has it put its strain on you, or has it just made you more alive and kind of fighting fit?
No, it's been a big strain, but that doesn't mean it's too many. It's all to do with scheduling the races, isn't it? So if you can, I think you can have 23 races if you have a good schedule, but you can't afford to have races where you fly to Australia and come home 4 days later. That doesn't work. The three race thing was tough, really tough for everybody. You never go home, you never do anything in normal life stuff. You just go from race to race to race to race, and it was bruising. And you know, journalists have a relatively easy time compared to some of the team people, particularly the motorhomers and the motorhome builders. Those people really take the brunt of it. So I think, you know, there shouldn't be three races in a row. I don't think that's sensible. Having said that, if you got rid of all the motorhomes, maybe there could be. But that's another argument, isn't it?
So I suppose you've got those teams of guys. The motorhome guys have got to be the last ones out. So presumably that's late Monday once all the admin and debrief is done. And then they've got to be at the next race, I guess, by Wednesday or even earlier.
Yeah, there was actually a very good video today by Mercedes-Benz about what they did from Austria to Silverstone. And it's brutal. I mean, they work through the night. They get everything done. These big motorhomes are broken down and on the move by midday on Monday. I mean, yeah, so what? But you're talking about fairly major constructions. And then they're driven 1,200 kilometers, rather, including a trip across the tunnel. And then rebuilt again, and they're supposed to be ready for Wednesday. So, yeah, it's tough, and particularly if you have a problem. McLaren, for example, had one truck that had a number of punctures in the course of the France to Austria and then Austria to Silverstone.
Yeah, but did they make up for it by that motorhome having just the best chassis out of all of them?
Very droll.
Ha.
No, the problem was that the chassis and the tractor unit were not talking to each other, so they actually had to get a new tractor unit in to fix it. But they got there. They worked day and night to do it. Now there is an argument that these things are sort of dinosaurs that are not needed anymore, but they are part of a brand statement about Formula One. So I don't know the answer. They cost a lot of money. There are probably better ways of doing it.
But don't they generate a lot of revenue? Because it is about ego. If you contribute money to a team in some way or another, or your company does, it's amazing. Even people of wealth, right down to your worker on the ground. If you give somebody nice stuff while they're coming to talk to you. I mean, I recently had a supplier meeting where we got our bellies tickled with, you know, Crest sandwiches, but they were cut into triangles and they got us proper pop and it was cold. And on a hot summer's day, I think that was enough to sway a few of the young engineers.
Well, I'm not sure that would work in Formula One terms, but...
So on a grand scale.
I think in Formula One terms, when the sponsors look at what their money's being spent on, and they look at these incredible edifices, these pantechnicons, multi pantechnicons, in fact, going from place to place, some of them are probably thinking, well, why on earth are we spending money on this? We should be spending money making the car go fast. And in the case of McLaren, that is probably more apposite than any other team, because they should be concentrating on making the cars go fast and not worrying about building motorhomes.
I'd sometimes wonder, though, if you're trying to, say, get, I don't know, Pepsi to come and sponsor you, it's not the shareholders of Pepsi that you're whining and dining. You need to get the guy who signs the check. And if you make that one individual happy and make him feel special, you know, sometimes that would make the motorhome and all the razzmatazz and sitting next to the driver worthwhile.
Not the kind of money you're talking about in F1. They are, you know, they want ROI, I believe the term is. They want return on investment. And they don't want to see any wastage. So I think I think the motorhomes are wasted. Wastage. I can see the logic behind them. But at the same time, you could spend the money, if you got all the teams to put their motorhome budget into a pot and then spread that out among the circuits of the world, you could build pretty nice garages everywhere.
Just mind minding that cable that's just causing some rustling again.
What am I supposed to do with it?
Nah, nothing.
Put it around my neck.
I don't think it is that. Now you're doing that. I think it might just be banging against the desk. But okay, it's all right. We'll get it in post. It wouldn't be half as glamorous, though. Yeah, what's that?
That was me hanging down my fingers on the desk just to check.
So I think that's what it might be. You might have a tick going on. But it wouldn't be half as glamorous, would it, on telly, watching Ted Kravitz tripping over tent poles and tent pegs and things like that. Doesn't F1, as the pinnacle of motorsport, need to just exude this glamour?
No, but if it had permanent facilities at some places, for example, in Bahrain or Abu Dhabi, they have permanent facilities in the paddock. They have it in Shanghai, but I mean, you know, walking between the two is like going to Moscow and back. You know, you just have to have it the right distance apart so that people come out. If you have it on the back of the garages, as they do in Malaysia, nobody ever comes out, so you can't talk to anybody. So, you know, it doesn't have to be tents. It can be permanent buildings. It could be permanent buildings. I mean, it's so much cheaper if a team arrives and just plugs things in.
Yeah.
As opposed to having to lay all the work and have these satellite dishes and all the kinds of rubbish they have. A lot of it's not necessary. So there is a lot of work going on with the Formula One group at the moment trying to ascertain what makes financial sense. And one of the things, for example, the pit we call it the Pratt perch.
Yes.
You know, where basically the beautiful people sit,
the pit wall
during a race, the pit wall units. They're all different. They're all expensive. They're all transported around the world. It doesn't make any sense. You know, just make them all the same. I mean, to be quite honest, you know, branding them differently. Yes, you can paint them a different color, but why on earth would you need to all design your own ones? It just makes no sense at all.
Bruce Wayne in the chat room would like a 70s style, just a small fence and a tent with camping chairs and tables. And Dom Byrne brings it back to logistics, saying, Joe, could 23 races be done Oh, that's two more than this week. And still retain the three-day Grand Prix weekend. And is that an ambition of F1?
I don't know if it's the ambition. It can be done. But if it is, if you're having races, you need to have two double headers. You need to have a race in Australia and a race followed a week later in Bahrain. So it makes sense. You need to have a race in China followed a week later by a race in Japan. You have to have a race in Sochi and a race in Baku, if we have to have either. You have to have a race in Canada and Mexico on weekends that follow. You know, this all makes sense. If you have one-off flyaways, it's expensive and it's tiring because, you know, when you get somewhere, you never, ever settle into a pattern because you're leaving before you settle into the pattern. So, you know, you just have to think about the human damage. And the human damage of 23 races can be the same as 19 races. But if you have two races in 8 days, as opposed to, cramming, well, not cramming, you just have ridiculous journeying to go out and back.
I remember when the English football teams had recovered from their European ban. That ages me a little bit. And they started having to play a lot more European fixtures, and then the Premiership started. That's when we started seeing squad rotation. So are the teams just not simply going to have to accept they can't take the same chief mechanic out, they can't take the same pit crew out, they're going to have to rotate it through the season? And can't they...
But that massively increases budget. The most expensive thing that Formula One has is more people. So what they don't want to do is that. So what you want to have is, and I think what Cyril, his argument is, that you don't want to make it commonplace. You don't want it to be like NASCAR, where they have 36 races a year. And it's just every weekend is a NASCAR race. I think they get 2 weekends off in the summer. Now, there are no press who follow the whole of the NASCAR championship. None at all. I doubt there are many crew who do the whole thing. The drivers do the whole thing, and the crew chiefs maybe. But, you know, but they rotate them in a different way. Crew come in on a Thursday and leave on a Saturday.
Yeah.
The race team is a completely different set of people to the ones who prepare the cars. So there's all kinds of things like that. And, of course, they have a geographical limitation as to where they go. In other words, they only fly around Trump land.
True.
They don't go outside. You know, Formula One has different challenges, but at the same time, it's possible to do it a lot better. And I think they'll find a way.
So they want to. It seems like if they want to do it, is the motivation more revenue, more tracks?
Basically, logic says that it's more revenue, more tracks. If you cut it back and only have high-paying 16 races, well, that's another matter. You know, how high can you push? If you've got government backing, it can go quite high, the numbers. But, you know, all the people have to get involved in that. So, you know, one has to ask the question, if you cut it back to 16, would Silverstone still make the cut? Would Monaco be in there? Because Monaco doesn't pay anything like the Russias or the Bakus of the world. So it's a balancing act. But I don't know the answer between whether you make it more special, only 16 and high-paying events, or you go to 23 relatively special and relatively high-paying events.
But that's very much from a business point of view. I'd like to ask the chat room now, now we've got low latency on, how many races do you want to see? Because personally, I hate waiting 3 weeks between a race. Yes, maybe the triple header was a little bit much, but I think if it was to go down to 16, you know, I'd feel like I would maybe lose interest, or some people would, and certainly I'd be climbing the walls waiting for the next race.
But hang on a minute. You've got to bear in mind also, it's not just a triple header. It's a triple header, 1 week off, and a double header. So we will have 5 races in 6 weekends, which basically wipes out your summer.
It does, for you. I'm at home on the sofa.
Lucky you.
you're right. You can have too much of a good thing. But here in the chat room, Mer Popcorn is saying 20 to 19. Kevin wants 23. Broken Tech wants 21. Artemy X, 20 is all right. 20, 21 seems to be about the sweet spot then.
Yeah, I don't mind. I mean, 20, we used to think of 20 as being hard to do. But as I said before, it's not about the number. It's about the way it's planned. And the problem they have at the moment is they're all still dealing with Bernie Eccleston contracts, which tie certain races to certain weekends. And so you can't change the calendar. Next year's calendar is going to be very similar to this year's calendar.
Don Byrne wants 52. clearly doesn't have a wife.
Clearly doesn't have a life, let alone the wife. I mean, you know, 52. Wow.
Ignore Joe. We live F1.
Hilmi Fawzi, there's a limit to living F1 when you've been divorced a couple of times, you know.
M. Hilmi Fawzi says that, was it NASCAR you were talking about earlier? 36 races a year, two of them are not on ovals. Yeah. You can see how that would quickly tire.
Can I just point out that they are adding a third road race later this summer in Charlotte?
Okay, so then, well, I want to talk about you at Trax, actually, as well, because in honour of Matt Trumpitz, who attended his first FIA event as an accredited journalist this weekend, so congratulations to Matt attending the New York E-Prix on behalf of Summer's F1, I just wanted to ask, you know, about when you started out, because I was feeling for Matt hanging around trying to get interviews. I've established I can't be that guy chasing people around with the mic. I mean, you weren't always Joe Saywood. Once upon a time, you were Joe Saywood. No one knew who Joe Saywood was. How did you find it at first? Were you naturally someone who was embarrassed or who could just go, oi, you, talk to me?
Well, when I started in European Formula 3. There was one British reporter. That was me. So generally speaking, the people I used to, actually on one or two occasions, I had a hammock which I slung up between the trees, and the drivers came to see me. Were the days. Now, I mean, in those days, you talk to everybody. You spent the whole weekend together. And if there's only a sum total of three journalists in the whole place and 10 spectators, you know, European F3 wasn't a huge hit, even in those days. It was a very much more relaxed world, so you got to know people better. You had more time. But, you know, they needed you.
Yes.
As much as you need them. Now, Formula E is a bit like that because, you know, if you were to sit down and say, well, why does Summers justify having a pass for an FIA championship? How many people does he have following him?
Loads.
Well, yeah, but compared to the West London Observer, example.
Fair enough.
It wouldn't be huge. Mm-hmm. You know, but you know, how are these things decided? These are questions that one has to look at. And obviously, if you're a young championship needing people, you're going to let in as many people as possible. So good for them. But in Formula One, you can't let everybody in. otherwise, you know, God knows who would turn up. There'll be people dressed as frogs and things like that turning up.
It's interesting about you saying they're needing you as well to get there. You're their like mouthpiece out to the real world. Mm-hmm. So I do the Daytona D-Max karting championships. If there's an incident on track, I know as soon as that race finishes, they're going to be running over to the comms box to get their side of the story across to make sure that I announce it over the tannoy that they were the ones who were run out of room.
And they will lead you up the garden path because and in the days when I was doing it in Formula 3, it was before there was any televised coverage of Formula 3 races. So, you know, you'd hear all these stories and you'd have time in those days as well. And I used to go out to where the accident happened and just sort of wander around, look at the tire marks and figure out who was where and who hit who, which makes you, it's very good for your ability to be an accident investigator. But, you know, you can't trust anything a racing driver tells you unless it's on television, in which case they try not to lie because then they'll be caught. But, you know, if they think there isn't anything televised, they'll tell you the biggest whoppers you ever heard.
But what's it like now? Because Mark Webber recently said, where did he say? I think it was in Autosport, that he felt that there was too much access to the drivers now. And he was hoping they could be a bit shielded and it could not become every day. Do you feel like you have access to drivers now? Obviously not in the press pen, but just like
absolutely
wandering
not.
Around.
And I think that's a load of old tosh. Much as I like Mark, you know, drivers have to learn that their job is as much dealing with the public, the customer, as it is dealing with the engineers. You know, it's ridiculous to say, you know, they don't get enough time to do whatever they do. Most of them spend their time picking their noses and playing computer games, you know, and I'm not kidding. You know, they just don't want to do the hard stuff. Whereas in the States, they'll go and they'll sign autographs for 5 hours because they're used to doing it. That's a tradition. So, you know, I think the drivers, they are busy people sometimes, but a lot of time they're not. And I think a lot of them make it up, really, to make them sound a little bit busy than they are. They are busy on Sundays, yeah.
So do you think for a kid coming through now, suddenly appearing in the paddock, is it harder than you had it?
Yeah, probably, because it's more regimented. In the old days, you could just go up to somebody and start talking. Now, admittedly, when I started doing it, I had the name Autosport behind me, which helps, opens doors. So if you're the Autosport reporter, you know, a lot of these Autosport reporters actually get a bit carried away. They think it's because everyone loves them and not the fact that they just said the word Autosport. A bit like some of the, it's a bit like some of the newspapers, you know. If they say The Sun, people go, yes, do come in, have a biscuit, you know. And if they say the West London Observer, they say, well, thanks a lot, bye. I don't even know if the West London Observer still exists, but I'm just using it as an example. But, you know, it's never been easy. It's never been easy. But, you know, when you arrive, you just have to get in there and do it. And nowadays, it's very easy if you arrive as a journalist just to follow the pack around from press conference to press conference, where you actually you get to see the drivers and they'll recognize your face. But you're not actually doing any real journalism. All you're doing is being a copy taker.
Yeah. So you're not even the one asking the questions in those scenarios.
Well, you can be the ones asking the questions, but the point is that everybody gets the answer. So you're not actually discovering anything else. You're just literally transcribing. In fact, they all share the transcription among themselves to make it easier. You know, one person transcribes and then gives it to everybody else, you know. So, you know, that's a safe way of doing it, but they're not really finding out any good information from that.
Speaking
he said, she said school of journalism, I call it.
What are you doing? You just caught, there's an avalanche. Joe, are you okay? There's an earthquake in your location.
No. I'm just, my desk moved, I suppose. I'm not allowed to move anymore.
Not on the shed's watch. He's not in France. He's genuinely in the shed. I forgot we pretend that. But you get a lot of good information, Joe, because you do go around talking to everybody. And I know that you talk a lot to Eric Boullier. And recently he quit. We've not actually had a chance to speak since he quit. Are we sure that he did quit? This wasn't one of these kind of we'll give you an opportunity to resign situations.
It's an interesting question. And to be honest, I haven't discussed it with Eric, but I believe that he did quit. He said to me some months ago that he didn't see an awful lot of point in doing what he was doing because he wasn't allowed to run the team how he wanted to. And so I can see him just eventually saying, I've got to go because all that's going to happen here, if he didn't believe in the structure in place, but he was going to get the blame for it, what was the point in staying? So I think that's probably what happened. Whether they pushed him that way or not is rather irrelevant.
May I ask then, what would Eric have done differently given that freedom?
He'd probably have fired half the management. And structured everything in a way in which someone reports to somebody else. The biggest problem at McLaren has long been this reporting problem. And also lack of focus, you know, all this tosh about going to do Le Mans, going to do IndyCars. Get real, folks. You are in a mess in Formula One. You have not got time to go messing around painting things orange in IndyCars. You have to focus on it. If your core business is F1 and you're doing a poor job at it, which is truly the case nowadays, you need to focus on it if you want to move forward. If you're going to make a further mess of it, you go and do other things and you don't focus. Or you focus on things that are not to do with racing cars. If you want to be successful in Formula One, you build a fast racing car. You don't try and market it more than everybody else. You just get on and build a fast car. The same problem exists at Williams.
So EMH2212 asks the same question I was about to, which is, Joe, do you think that McLaren will finally get rid of the matrix system of moolahs that Ron Dennis put in yonks ago? Now, I work for a large engineering firm, and I think we have a similar system where basically we have a lot of managers and department heads who have a domain, and then they have to kind of go and bid for someone's time. So, Joe, I need 15 hours of your time this month to work on this kind of thing. But then that person or you might actually have seven different managers to report to in different areas. It can get very mucky, but it's not an uncommon engineering approach.
Yeah, but it doesn't work in Formula One. Formula One is all about having a boss to report to. And in fact, the ironic thing about McLaren is that McLaren didn't really discover the depth of the problem they had until Ron Dennis wasn't there anymore, because ultimately, subconsciously, everyone still thought of Ron as the boss. So, you know, there was always somebody who would always call the shots. Once Ron's gone, I think the problem exacerbated itself because nobody was calling the shots. It was just drifting along. So, I think that Zach Brown, who is apparently in charge, needs to pick it up and grab it and make it work. If he doesn't, he needs to be kicked out the door. But then again, why is he running a racing team? I don't really understand that, because he's a marketing man. He was brought in to sell sponsorship, not to run racing teams. So I don't really get it, to be honest. And I think we need to see some more change there. I don't know what change, but certainly we need to have a true technical head. We need to have a technical director who is the man in charge, and so that somebody takes the blame and somebody calls the shots.
Like a proper hierarchy, but
a dictatorships work best.
But I thought you didn't like Trump.
Nor do I. I don't like Trump, but he's not a dictator, is he? He's the other bloke I don't like.
Not yet. Okay. Mark Greenow asks...
The puppet master, should I say. Oh, oops.
Oh, right. Okay. Mark Greenow, does Joe think Alonso holds too much power at McLaren? There were some distinctly Alonso-ish names when they announced the replacement structure to Eric Boullier.
It's a very interesting question.
Well done, Mark.
Why would you give power to a driver who's not going to be there for very much longer?
Well, I assume that meant that he is going to be there.
Yes, between 12 and 36 months, he's going to be there. But that's not long-term thinking, is it? And you can barely solve a problem in that time, let alone... So why would you be giving him the power? I mean, he's got nowhere to go in his career apart from IndyCars. And nobody wants him in Formula One. I'm sorry to have to say this, but that's the truth of it. None of the big teams want him because he's a disruptive force. So although he's a great driver, don't take that away from him at all. He's a fantastic driver, but they don't want him. Red Bull could have him. They don't want him. Ferrari could have him. They don't want him. Mercedes could have him. They don't want him. Is the message coming across here? So why would you try to make him happy except keeping him for another year maybe? But he's got nowhere to go. So he can either leave Formula One, in which case McLaren's in trouble, but it's still not good enough to have him calling the shots to any extent. Drivers should not dictate what teams do.
Could they just be in awe of him and they're just making bad decisions based on his persona?
No. Well, if anyone's in awe of a driver and you're running a Formula One team, you're in the wrong job.
Well, maybe someone's in the wrong job,
you're
Joe.
You're the boss. You're the boss. You're saying, you do this, you do that, and driver, shut up and drive. Now, whether or not you know better how to do it than he does, that's not the point. That's not your job. Your job is to make the thing work. So having a driver telling you how to do things isn't right. So if you're in awe of the driver, you're in the wrong job.
And so then, what next for Eric Boullier? I mean,
he's going to have a year with gone gardening leave.
Ah, so he'll get his nice paycheck for a year and then...
Well, he won't like that because he's a competitive guy. People don't like their time off because, they just sit around getting bored and frustrated. He wants to be back in the fray. He's a very talented guy. Some people don't like him because that's inevitable. Some people don't like me, amazingly,
What?
But that's, that's the way of the world. But I'm sure he has sufficient talents and sufficient passion to get a job, an important job somewhere else. And if he doesn't, he'll go off and do something else, which gives him pleasure in the world of motorsport.
Think Williams could
I don't
do
know.
With him? Do you think Williams could do with him?
Well, Williams could do with something, couldn't they?
So I've heard, and tell me if I'm wrong, I know you speak to much more important people than I do, but we're hearing on more than one occasion here at Mist Apex Towers, /shed, that morale is low in the Williams factory, and that at least some of that is down to the fact that they don't have faith that their drivers will extract everything out of what they build, whatever they build.
That is a very sound assessment, I would say, of the likely situation at Williams, and I have heard it said myself.
What a shame, though. What a shame for like such a talented team of engineers.
Leadership is the key, and leadership in every form, not just in terms of picking up the team and driving it forward, but in terms of making sure that the engineers do a good job. There's a lot of arse covering that goes on in Formula One, but at the end of the day, somebody has to take the rap for these things. And, you know, this year's car, the chief aero and the chief designer are both gone. Okay, maybe they, you know, maybe they felt they wanted to go, whatever.
Yeah.
But certainly Paddy Lowe can't afford to have two bum cars.
Well, I was going to say, if this was a championship football team, Paddy Lowe would be gone by now.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, you've also got to look at Formula One in a way that it takes time to build success. You can't just turn up and do it. Not anymore. And so team managers, team principals tend to be like football managers. You know, you lose an important game, you get booted out. Now, that's not necessarily the most efficient way of doing it, but that's how it is.
Now then, Joe, you were talking about the prospect of people not liking you. Shock horror. Like, surely that could never happen. But I saw you in your natural environment in the Strand Palace Hotel a week and a half ago. And for the people who don't know this, Joe, you do a live audience in front of, you know, between 30 and 150 people all around the world when you do when you're at Grand Prix.
Yeah, I do. But, I don't find that a problem. There's always people who are skeptical. There are a lot of people who come along thinking I'm a mean, nasty, grumpy bastard.
But they pay.
Because on the blog, sometimes they get the impression, because I'm very short on my replies. It's only because I don't have time. I'm a completely lovable, big, cuddly person, really. But, you know, you don't see that unless you come along to the audiences.
So I endorse that on your blog, your answers are like, I mean, some people feel the need, like on their own blogs and things like that, to be very kind of PR and corporate and HR about it and like very customer service. And you just go, no, tosh, rubbish, you know, and it's just like three words and that's your comment done.
Yeah, but if I read something and there's nothing of any serious value in it, what am I supposed to do? I haven't got time to be polite. Do you want stock answers, you know, to the best of my knowledge at this moment in time,
yeah,
with all due respect, blah-de, blah-de, blah. You're an idiot. And, you know, no. It's just better to go no, yes, whatever. But I don't think people realize how much time. You know, if you have – I think I've said this before, but if you have 200 comments a day,
yes,
and you spend 2 minutes on every comment, that's 400 minutes. Where does that come from? That's 3 hours and 40 minutes, I think, not being a mathematical genius.
So I do tend to give people a little bit more time when they email me and it feels more like a letter. And then we have exchanges like that and they can be done over time. So if people email me at SpanishReady@gmail.com, far more likely to sit down and consider that. But yeah, when you get like a wall of YouTube comments just saying you're an idiot and it would be, the show would be better without you and just Matt, that's the most hurtful ones. It can.
Yeah, but after a while, they don't hurt.
But I'll tell you what was interesting. When you and I started doing these podcasts together, we had a very different demographic of audience. So, on your blog, when you posted the thing, people would go, who is this Wally? Who's this, that person just jumping around like a puppy dog? And then on my website and on my comments, it would be, who's this grumpy curmudgeon? You know, that it was like a clash of worlds. And, what I will say to people who are considering going to your live audiences, when you see Joe here in the shed, Joe is very much fitting into the Mist Apex way of doing things. He's having to deal with me asking stupid questions. And also, we focus very much on current F1, commentating on current F1. The audience with Joe's are just fantastic. I've been to two now. You go into a lot of stories. You go into a lot of general ethos. And there's a lot of yarns that go on. Plus, you have an answer for every question that comes in. Now, one of the best things about it is a lot of it is off the record. However, we did record most of a show at the Strand that I attended with you. We recorded most of it. I have to say we did have to stop the recording on quite a few occasions because they're the things that are reserved for the live audience and there can be no evidence. However, I believe that live recording gives you a great flavour of Joe Saywood, an audience with Joe Saywood. You can purchase that from us. It is behind a paywall on MistApexPodcast.com. In the menu, in fact, it's /Joe Saywood. But in the menu, you can select an audience with Joe. For the price of a movie rental, $4.95, you can have 2 hours and 15 minutes of the audio that would not land Joe specifically in a courtroom. So consider buying that, and I think that will whet your appetite for attending his next event. Joe, did I cover all the bases there? I think I did.
That was a very, very great piece of promotional activity. Yes, wonderful.
Getting better this
thing. I should add there that I also enjoy doing the audiences because I am interacting with punters on a very much of a one-to-one basis. And I really like that because you get a buzz from the enthusiasm. Often on blogs and on social media, you don't get the same buzz because it's just like endless abuse. And it's very, I have people who say positive things, but of course the abusers just come in and say, well, you only let people who write positive things make comments and all this sort of tosh. But, you know, the fact is that social media is fundamentally a negative thing. Yeah. And I don't want it to be. I want it to be a positive thing. But just the kind of people who are motivated to use it are negative. And I understand that. You know, if I'm in an airport and my airline has screwed me around, I'll go on social media and say bad things about the airline just because I'm grumpy.
Yeah, it's like TripAdvisor. People only write bad reviews when they've had a bad time in a hotel. Rarely do they sit there and go, everything was fine, actually, and they're motivated. It's like those old teletext quizzes. They'd say, you know, do you agree with the poll tax, disagree, or have no strong opinion one way or the other? Like, who bothered going on there and selecting, I have no strong opinion one way or another? The people are asking in the chat room, which audiences you're doing this year? Do you have a quick lineup?
As far as I know, right now, I shall be doing one in Singapore, and I shall be doing one in Austin, and I think that's all for the year. I might try and do something in Abu Dhabi, but it's very complicated over there to get things organized. So I don't know. We'll see. But those are the two left. And I will also do one in London, probably in the week after the end of the season.
And I'll try and convince Joe to come and do something live with Missed Apex Podcast and an audience at some point. However, you can, on the 4th of August, come to Buckmore Park at 11 a.m. and you can watch a live recording of Missed Apex Podcast. And then we'll be karting at 1:30. We've got one seat available. There's definitely all the podcast people that you'll recognize and a couple of drivers from the world of motorsport that you will recognize as well. Now then,
apart from me, because that's the first day of my holidays and you're not getting me anywhere near Bucknell Park.
Well, you were invited as an honored guest. Just know that Joe came up with a plausible excuse.
I understand that, yes, but I only get X number of weeks a year holiday, and I'm going to be heading south across France to somewhere quiet and peaceful.
Right, Red Bull, Joe. Let's talk about Red Bull, because things have gone frosty now, haven't they, with Red Bull and Renault, with Max Verstappen pulling an Alonso with his F2 engine. I've got an F2 engine. That's going to be awkward for the rest of the season, isn't it?
Not really, because they've said far worse in the past. So, you know, it's a fractious relationship because they want to be successful. But what they never worked out is that abusing your engine supplier doesn't really help. Something that McLaren and Honda might have worked on a little bit harder as well. So, yes, Red Bull are going to Honda next year. And I'm sure one of the things that Honda worried about before they signed the deal was whether or not Red Bull would give them a load of abuse. And well, you've got to think about it.
Well, at the moment, Christian Horner's being really, really nice. And he's saying, well, we know how much they're investing. We've seen what they're doing. For us, it's all about performance. And he backs Honda to have more performance than Renault. And for him, that's the bottom line. But are Red Bull going to give Honda that freedom? Or in reality, do Red Bull really want to be able to control that interface, the synergy and the meeting between the engine and the car?
If they think they're going to control the Japanese, they're dreaming.
You're not painting a positive picture of harmony ahead.
No, I'm not. But I'm just saying, if they try to do it that way, it's not going to work because the Japanese go and do their own thing. So you've just got to hope they do their own thing better than everybody else. And trying to flog them to death doesn't necessarily help, as we've seen with the McLaren situation. So you just have to handle relationships with great care.
So you
particularly as the Japanese, loss of face is a very important thing.
Pride. So a lot of professional pride.
Not pride, loss of face. It's slightly different. It's being embarrassed by other people.
I won't pretend to understand Japanese culture, but French culture, we're both perhaps a little bit more familiar with. And it's interesting now with the driver situation, because I was going to ask you about signs, and I still will, because on Sky TV, I was like, look, it's Joe on telly. You were talking about Sainz having talks with McLaren. Now, it's really interesting listening to Cyril Abidebo talking about having to line up another driver in case Sainz goes off somewhere. But then in the same breath...
I think Cyril might have been twisting things around a bit. He probably has to say that. But Cyril and the Renault boys want Esteban Ocon. If Force India is in a bad state of affairs and Mercedes aren't confident that Force India is a good place for Esteban Ocon, Esteban Ocon will move somewhere else. The logical place to move is Renault, and therefore that might displace Carlos Sainz. I'm not saying any of this will definitely happen, but this is the silly season. This is the time when you have all these different possibilities being discussed. And all you can do as a journalist is report the fact that this is being discussed. Will it happen in the long term? I mean, everyone can say, look at you, you got it wrong. I didn't get it wrong. When I wrote things, it was right at the time. This was being discussed. I'm not saying this is happening. So it's just one of those things that happens. You know, you say this might happen and everyone goes, what a load of rubbish. But it's amazing how often these things actually come to pass later on as well. And of course, by the time Jacques Villeneuve said to me the other day, he said, one of the things about being in the media is if you say something right, 6 months later it comes true and you were right, but everyone's forgotten you said it. And that's very true.
Yes, that happens to me all the time. That happens to me all the time. I have big arguments with Matt Trumpets. Last season, after testing last season, I said Mercedes are going to disappear and vanish off into the distance, performance-wise. And then for the first half of the season, while Mercedes were doing this silly strategy stuff, everyone was like, no, Ferrari have still got the best package. They've still got the best package. Mercedes would somehow struggle to set something up. And they go, see, Ferrari was the fastest car. Once the dominance set in, no one turned around and went, do you know what, Spanners? You were bang on about that. Not one person.
You're bang on there, Spanners.
Nice one, mate. Do you feel pressure on Sky TV, though? Because they bring you on. Do you feel pressure to kind of come up? You know, it's boring to say, well, we'll just have to wait and see. You can't possibly just sit there and say that, can you?
No, but if you do enough of this stuff, it just becomes natural to you. Do you think that David Croft goes on a show and is nervous before the show? No.
Yeah, but
because if you are, you're not going to be very good at it. It's part of the job, I suppose.
Does David Croft, as amazing as a commentator as he is, does he ever stick his neck out on the line like you do? He tends to be quite cautious and quite neutral in his speculation.
Well, oddly enough, because I'm at all the races, I don't watch Sky.
Ah, yeah, good point. All right, fair.
So I don't know. I mean, I know Crofty. He's very opinionated, and sometimes he's wrong, amazingly. And sometimes he's right. But, you know, it's very difficult to judge people if you never see what they're doing. And added to which, you know, could say, well, record it and watch it. Well, you can't get it in France, can you? So either which way, unless Sky Television sends me their videos, and I can – yeah, that's cheating if you do it that way. But, you know, unless you actually can see the shows being produced, you can't really judge them. And it's unfair to judge them. You know, that's for the spectators to judge.
We're spoiled in the UK, though. You know, some people complain about Channel 4, Eddie Jordan. Some people complain about Sky coverage. But really, we do have two top-notch networks on a worldwide scale, don't we, covering F1? Right, fair enough. I've answered my own question. You're there in the paddock. You're not actually watching it. Interestingly, Cyril Abitbol, I think I've rehearsed that.
Abitbol.
Oh, come on. I was close enough. I could have had that. No one would have known. He is talking about his Renault juniors. And he was citing how Mercedes and Ferrari have all got, and Red Bull have got their platforms in F1. And he was, you know, this really is now a big push by Renault to be one of the big proper teams. Like he even said, it wasn't going to happen with Red Bull. And then this one, he said, it's not going to happen with McLaren. So is McLaren not seen as a traditional customer team then? That's an odd dynamic.
From their point of view, Renault's point of view, they've got two what should be decent top teams, their own team and the Renault team. Sorry, their own team and the McLaren team. The thing is that neither one is performing as well as they should be, given their heritage or given the state of investment they're at. So there is potential that's not being exploited. You know, having Red Bull disappearing off somewhere else is a loss for Renault. But at the same time, they want to be winning with their own team. Because what's the point of winning with Red Bull because your engines are called Tag Heuers? or Aston Martins or whatever, you know. It doesn't make any sense. So getting rid of no longer having that relationship clarifies things a lot.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
And they want their drivers in. They want French drivers. Is there room for Romain Grosjean? Because he's going to be out of the seat fairly soon, isn't he?
I would think that's a very sound assessment of something or other. I don't see him at Renault, no.
No, oh, that's a shame. But, I mean, he's got to be he's struggling at Haas, isn't he? It's just, it's so consistent.
Well, except the fact he did a terrific job the other day, finished ahead of Kevin, and then screwed it up the next race. So, Romain's a terrific...
I know.
He's a terrific driver, and he's a great guy. But he just keeps making mistakes. And I don't know if it's a pressure thing. It's very, very hard to explain. And I'm not sure he can explain it himself.
But so, at Silverstone, it wasn't even one mistake. I mean, he crashed in qualifying at turn one, missing the button. He then hit his own teammate understeering or locking the brakes and then finished it off by being mostly to blame with Carlos Sainz. So, I mean... It's an extraordinary amount of mistakes for us over the course of a season. We're not used to quite seeing that level, are we?
Yeah, he's made a lot. Yeah, it hasn't helped him. That's very true. The other thing is, of course, if you look at it from a psychological point of view, Kevin has been getting inside his head. And that is a key point. The psychological game between teammates is a very key part of success and failure in Formula One.
So I'm seeing Haas as actually really challenging for being the number four, number five team consistently. This relationship they seem to have with Ferrari, the step up they've made this year. They've got Kevin Magnussen there, who you might argue is A-, B-plus in the racing driver echelon.
He's better than that.
I'm pleased to hear you say that, because he didn't obviously impress against Jenson Button. He was up against Jenson Button, wasn't he?
He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And also, you've got to have the right support at the right stage in your career. And he didn't feel supported by McLaren. He didn't feel at home. And of course, he knew in the background that Alonso would probably turn up and turf him out. So it's not good. A driver performs best when he's comfortable. And so the skill is to make your driver as comfortable as possible.
So you think that Kevin Magnussen can push on if he's comfortable and he's in a competitive team, which it looks like Haas is going to be?
Well, maybe since then, Kevin Magnussen has learned how to do it and doesn't need that support. You see, the thing is, we judge people at a certain time and say this happened, then therefore, but they develop, they change.
Danes are made of strong stuff, and certainly he comes across as a very strong personality now.
Yes. He is, and he's a very interesting person, and that doesn't necessarily come across, but it is.
It does a bit. It does a bit. It does come across a bit. He does seem interesting.
He's a Viking, you know, but he's one of, there's only two, here's a quiz for you. How many drivers are interested in the history of the sport in Formula One at the moment?
Sure. Vettel, Magnussen.
One, Magnussen two. That's it. Have I told you that before? I must have done.
No, no. So you think the other guys genuinely aren't that interested?
I mentioned that at the audience the other day, you cheater.
Yeah, but you kept buying me beer, so, you know, that doesn't count. Someone did anyway.
It wasn't me. I'm far too cheap for that.
It was an interesting drive home. No, I'm joking. I took the train. Calm down, everyone. Anyway, I'm loving
this. Watch out. Sean Todd will have you up against the wall and shot if you're drinking and driving. Good Lord. If Sean Todd had seen the motorcycle display teams going on behind the bus full of French footballers yesterday or the day before, whenever it was, he would have had kittens, because I've never seen such chaos in my life. I'm surprised that there aren't large numbers of them dead.
And now then, I want to finish up really by talking about Mercedes, because we've seen some real interesting comments. We know Lewis Hamilton is really emotional, and we kind of expect that. We know these guys are emotional in general. I mean, Sebastian Vettel, in Italian, was shouting in their backyard at the end of the British Grand Prix. So we know he's emotional. Lewis Hamilton staggered away, didn't want to talk to Martin Brundle just after the race either. He came under a lot of pressure. And then perhaps a misjudged comment suggesting it might have been deliberate. And hands up, he's come on social media and said, yeah, that was dumb. Sorry. What was more surprising was hearing Toto Wolff and James Allison clearly exasperated by being hit by Ferraris, and, you know, that comment that they're having to decide whether it's incompetence or malice. It's not something we're used to seeing from Mercedes. Toto Wolff has been fantastic at being fun, lighthearted, and corporate. After Silverstone, we saw genuine sportsmen under pressure.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, they have been hit by Ferrari rather a lot. There's twice, I think, now. But they've been two very significant events which have damaged their point scoring ability. And to be fair, I thought Kimi deserved more of a penalty than he got at Silverstone. I thought that was just a fairly incompetent move. And he got 5 seconds, which had no impact on him at all, whereas Lewis had to fight his way through.
Yeah,
all got, the way up.
He got 10, I think, 10 seconds, but still,
right,
exactly 5, the same. 10,
whatever, it was. Yeah. It wasn't a huge number. And he didn't, you know, by the time he took the penalty, he didn't lose anything, you know. So I can see their frustration. But, you know, at the same time, you'd like to hope that people don't crash into one another deliberately. And I don't think it was deliberate. I just think it was incompetent, to be honest. So.
Now this is interesting, because a lot of people are thinking of Ferrari right now as being in the ascendancy, leading the championship. However, the feeling I'm getting still, and I argue with Matt about this endlessly, is that actually, deep down, Mercedes have got this much stronger package. Ferrari, to my mind, have fallen away the last four races, but it's been disguised by Monaco. It's been disguised by a couple of bad strategy calls. I've got this feeling that Ferrari, in their own camp, have got an underdog mentality where they can be more aggressive and go for it, and that might lend itself to a few more incidents. So it's not malice. They've just got this go for it, nothing to lose policy.
Yeah, that could be that. It could be that. I think it's a very interesting call as to who's got the faster car, because I think that Mercedes has the faster car, but they don't always use it with the tyres as well as Ferrari does.
Sure.
You know, the Ferrari, and let's be clear here. Racing in Formula One this year is very, very circuit specific and very tire specific.
Certainly.
And very often that's temperature specific. So to some extent, it's also luck, because you've got to have the right tires on at the right temperature. Now, Ferrari have played the tire game better. The strategy game, you'd have to say that Mercedes has looked a bit weak, although quite often there are explanations as to why they made the decisions they made. And they're not stupid. You know, it's just that things don't work out for you when things aren't working out. So I still think that Mercedes will win the championship. But it changes all the time. So let's see.
In your opinion, do Ferrari indeed have now the better engine?
No.
I thought that was a bold claim, to be honest. When everyone was saying that at the last race, that felt like a, well, hang on, that snuck up on us, if that's true. And if it is true, that must mean that Mercedes have got an amazing chassis. So,
well, it's to do, I mean, there's so many different things, you know, because you can say, well, look at the straight line speed, but that's down to the downforce, that's down to the wing settings, it's down to a lot of stuff. So it's very, very hard to say who's got the more powerful engine. You've also got the different modes, you know, where it can be turned up or not turned up. So I think it's very difficult to sort of say with any great clarity, this is definitely more powerful than that. And I think since Monaco, Mercedes have looked better, but their reliability has been suspicious.
You've got to convert it as well, haven't you?
Yes, exactly. If you have the speed, you've still got to turn it into the result.
Okay, let's hand this over to the chat room for the last 5 minutes, because Caleb is asking, will Force India win a race? And then he later asks, will any team such as Haas or Force India ever win a race? Tell you what, let's put it another way. Who's the next team, apart from Red Bull, Ferrari, Mercedes, who are going to win a race, even over the next 5 years? Who's got that potential to pop
Renault.
Up? Renault seriously going to wake up as a manufacturer?
No. Renault, I think, will become a race winner before too long. Maybe a couple more years. I can see McLaren, if they do the right things, getting back to where they should be, but only if they do the right things. I don't see anybody else unless there are new engines coming in, and we don't know what new engines are coming in. Because in order to be, if you're a customer team, you're fundamentally at a disadvantage.
However, if you were going to say Renault is going to go on and nick a race at some point, I mean, they're not qualifying in the top six unless there's a failure.
I said within the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, so it's going to be dominated by those top three for the foreseeable future, isn't it?
Yes, but things change. Things go up, things go down. Williams and McLaren used to be the stars of the show. Where are they now?
Oh, here we go. There's a good one from Don Byrne. Will Hülkenberg ever finish on the podium?
I hope so. He deserves to.
I don't think he is cursed. Europeans said he's cursed. But to be fair, he has had chances. For example, Baku 2016, he was running in the podium slots. So it's not that I don't think he's cursed. It's when the opportunities have come up, it hasn't been his day. Perez, on the other hand, when he's had those opportunities, he's gone in and nicked them. I know not many people are Perez fans, and I'm somewhat on my own in that. But when you can't deny, when he's had opportunities at Sauber and Force India for podiums, he's grabbed them, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. No question about that. Yeah.
Joe, thank you very much for your time. It is sweltering hot here in the UK and in France. I think we all have to just accept that it's going to be hot forever now and just stop moaning about it or moan about it forever. Joe, where can people catch up with you? You do some fantastic blogs. They're like 2,000 words long. You open like this Joe's notebook and you just give this whole summary of your travels and the places you've been. You think it's going to be about Formula One, and it is, and then it's not for 200 words, then it is again. I genuinely enjoy reading those.
I'm very pleased to hear it. Joe Blogs F1 will see you all right. Also, Grand Prix Plus, don't forget that. It's still the most terrifically ridiculous magazine that comes up 6 hours after each race. And for those who are seriously inclined, the Joe Sayward Business of Motorsport newsletter, which is available from it's flatoutpublishing.com.
Still waiting for mates rates, Joe?
Yeah, well, you're going to wait for a while.
Gosh darn. Well, you guys don't have to wait very long, because Sunday, 8 p.m., we're going to be doing a review of the German Grand Prix. I'm going to be joined by Chris Rainbow Sparkle Stevens, Matt Two Rumpets, and Nick Alexander making his debut, as well as grumpy old Steve looking after the chat room. So make sure you join us for that. Until next time, remember that wounds heal, chicks dig scars, and glory lasts forever. This was Missed Apex with Joe, who's on the telly sometimes. When are you next on telly? We like seeing you on TV. We want more Joe on TV.
Well, I think Sky quite liked it, actually. But the trouble is I'm in the wrong country. So I pass through on a Wednesday, maybe we'll do some more. But I don't pass through on a Wednesday very often. So
tell them I'll sub in for you next time. They'll be delighted to know I'm available.
You never know.
You didn't have to laugh. You didn't have to laugh quite so hard, Joe.
I didn't laugh at all. Nothing would surprise me. Why not?
Joe Sayward, thank you very much. We'll see you very soon. Have a great German Grand Prix.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.